I love books.
I love books. Books are old friends. I have over 4,000 books. I have rooms full of books. I've read lots and lots of fat books. I like skinny books. I like old books. I like new books. I bought some new books yesterday at the book sale, and my wife goes, you know, why do I need more books? Well, why do you need more friends? You can't get too many friends, but she thinks I can get too many books. You've been to my house. I have lots of books, huh? Yes, I do. And I love books. I've read this one 1.5 times. I'm almost through it the second time. I have some I've read 4, 5, 6 times. I mean, how many times do you go up to a friend and say, my, I want to spend time with you? I do that with books. Now, I like pictures, you know, that nice picture. I like lots of things, but I love books. How many of you have ever heard of this man? Eddie Rickenbacker. Some people call him Eddie Rickenbacker, which is okay. You know, some people say it one way and some another, but that's all right. I don't know how to say it, so I say it whatever way I want. That's the nice thing about books. You know, if I'm reading a book about a guy riding a horse, I get to decide what color the horse is, not some guy out in California that puts it on TV. If he's wearing a hat and it doesn't say what kind of hat, I get to decide what color hat it is and what it looks like. I love books. Eddie Rickenbacker, I'll use that way. He, as a kid, he was about 12 years old when his daddy was killed. His daddy had a very dangerous job working on a pile driver. That's a big machine that drives things in the ground, you know, and a piece of wood flew off, hit him in the head, fractured his skull. He lived a while and finally died. And Eddie had several brothers and sisters. He had to quit doing what he was doing and get a job to help feed the kids. 12 years old. A lot of responsibility for a 12-year-old boy. But God had gifted him. He was a mechanical genius. He could fix things. I mean, he could fix things. One day he was working for a man that sold cars. Way back when cars were kind of cars, you know. Had wheels about this narrow, stood about this high off the mud road. Very famous man bought one of these cars, and cars in those days were not like cars today, and it broke down. That was way out in the country, and somehow he got the message to the guy that sold the car, said, get somebody out here and fix this car. Eddie was about 17 or 18 years old, and so he was sent out to this famous man's car to fix it. And can you imagine, here comes this guy on a bicycle to fix my car. Some kid. Who are you? Well, I came to fix your car. Yeah, sure. Well, it wasn't very long until he had it going, you know, and off they went back to where the guy, you know, bought the car. And he said, who's that kid you sent out there? He said, he's our best mechanic. I knew he could fix your car. That's why I sent him out there. He must be a pretty good guy. Well, he is. He's the best we've got. Anybody in here about that age, 18 or 17? How would you like to be known as the best we've got? Well, anyway, he continued working with cars, and I know you've never heard of this guy, but, you know, I've read about him in my books. Barney Oldfield. Have you ever heard of him? He was a very, very... Now, come on. Just because you have whiskers, you don't have to know everything I know. Anyway, Barney Oldfield was a very famous race car driver. Back in the days when race cars had big, tall wheels with wooden spokes and would scream down the road around the track at, you know, 50, 60 miles an hour. In those cars, you had a driver and you had another guy, you know, and the other guy, he had jobs too, like changing gears or whatever. I mean, you know, cars were different in those days. Well, Eddie raced with him, and then he decided after a while he did all kinds of things, and one day he found that he had accumulated some money, and so he started his own car company, and he built the Rickenbacker car. I've got pictures of him in one of my books here. The Rickenbacker car. You never heard of that, have you? I had never heard of one either until I read about it in here. But there's some pretty nice looking cars, I have to tell you. But then after a while, went on and on and on, and he kind of lost interest in cars and became the owner and president of Eastern Airlines, which was a pretty big airline in his day, because he decided airplanes, that's it. I remember, he says, back when I was in the First World War, he was a pilot. Not just a pilot, he was the best fighter pilot we had. He shot down 26 enemy planes. And that was more than anybody else. And so he was the ace of aces. Everybody knew that he was a real whiz at mechanics. And so one day he was riding one of his Eastern Airline planes into the airport in Atlanta. I don't know what happened, but the plane crashed. He was severely injured. He was laying under part of the plane covered with aviation fuel. Not a very good place to be. And he was trapped and he couldn't move. And they were trying to get him out. And because he's always the boss, it seems, he was giving them instructions on what to do and how to get him out, and others out too. He was in the hospital for 4 months. He almost died. His wife was named Adelaide, and she said, he's got lots of things yet to do in his life. He won't die. And he didn't. He got out. He walked with a cane, but he got out. And one day in October 1942, Secretary of War was named Stimson. Franklin Roosevelt, Secretary of War, got a hold of him and said, Eddie, come to Washington. I need you. He lived in New York. So he came to Washington, and Secretary Stimson got him in his private office and said, I've got to get a secret message to General MacArthur. Would you take the message for me? I can trust you. Well, yes, I'll be glad to. Well, now he's to meet you at this little island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. I can't let you write this message down. You've just got to memorize it and get him by himself and give it to him personally. I will. What's the message? Gave him the secret message, whatever it was, and he memorized it. Is this what you said? Yep, that's it. Okay, I've got it. All right, there's a plane waiting for you at the airport. It will take you from here to Hawaii. In Hawaii, we will have another plane ready to take you to this island. On the map, it was just called Island X. Can you imagine? Little island didn't even have a name, just had X. Well, he got to Hawaii, and he had a military aide that was sent with him, probably, you know, to help protect him because he was very important. He had this secret message. But they call these military aides a French word, attaché. He was a military attaché. And he was right attached to him the whole time. You know, wherever he went, the attaché went. Well, they got over to Hawaii, and well, there was another group. I need to tell you about this group. This was a B-17 bomber group. A B-17 bomber is a flying fortress. It's a great big long wing plane with four big engines. And this bomber crew, five guys, were coming into Hawaii thinking, oh boy, we get to go home for a while. One guy had gotten married. He was 24 years old. And he had a two-day honeymoon, and then he had to go off back to war to the Pacific. He was anxious to get back home to see if he remembered his wife, you know. And there was another guy on there who was 23, and he was engaged to be married, and he thought, when I get back home, I'm going to marry that girl before she decides to marry some guy with a bigger hat. And then there was a couple of guys that was a pilot and a co-pilot that were experienced guys in their 40s that had been in the war and had got out of the Air Corps, as they called it in those days, and one of them, by the name of Cherry, that was his last name, he was a pilot for American Airlines, and then he went back into the Air Corps, and he was supposed to be flying transport planes, but they put him on a bomber. And then there was another guy by the name of James Whitaker, which was the main story I'm going to tell you. He's a very important person, so don't forget his name, James Whitaker. He was the co-pilot. Well, after he got out of the Air Corps, he owned a construction company. But when you love to fly, you love to fly, you love to fly, and he went back in, and he was up flying again. Well, when they landed in Hawaii thinking, oh boy, I get to go home for a while, there was orders waiting for them. We have a very important mission for you. You've got to take this guy who is the number one ace pilot of the World War I and his military what? Attaché. Yeah, you know, you can speak French too. Attaché. I like that word. You know, there's another French word I have trouble with. I have to hold my nose to say it because it's croissant. Can you say that? Those little pieces of bread, you know?
Croissant. Croissant.
I can't even say it with my nose held. Well, anyway, you don't need to know that. You can forget that. Well, he and the attaché got on, and they took off, and they were going down the runway, and a plane, big old lumbering thing, you know, going down, got up to 60 miles an hour, going down, getting ready to take off out over the ocean. And the right tire blew. And the brake locked up. Talk about troubles. That's the thing you don't want to happen when you're just taking off, because the plane took off like this and headed toward a building. And Commander Sherry was the pilot, and he said, oh, brother, or words to that effect. I bet he didn't say attaché, do you think? Well, anyway, it headed toward a building. And so he started doing what they call ground loops, which donuts is what they are. Like this, trying to get it to slow down. Finally, it got stopped. Well, I guess we're going to have to change planes. So they took another B-17, unloaded all the stuff they had already loaded, and put it back on the other plane. Now, they didn't have much experience with that plane. But the navigator had this instrument, very technical instrument. You know, the sailors had a thing they called a sextant, you know, that they looked through, and they looked at the North Star, or they looked at the sun or something else, and they could tell you exactly where you were on a map. Boop, right here, this is where we are. Well, they had improved that. It wasn't called a sextant anymore. Now it was called an octant. I guess it went from 7 to 8 or something. It went from anyway, they had an octant, and it was in its package. And well, as they were doing these ground loops, things were kind of flying around in there, including the octant. Well, when they transferred to the new plane, the navigator looked at his octant, and it looks pretty good to me. I think it's okay. Well, what they didn't know was it had been banged around enough that it now was out of caliber, you know. Where they thought they were going that way, they really were going a little bit off. So here they were. They took off and they got out over the ocean and they were heading toward point X on the map. And the navigator said, okay, take this heading. And the pilot, and away they went. And every now and then, the navigator would get his octant out and he would check it, however you do it. I don't know how you do it. But anyway, he would say, adjust your course just a little bit, you know, or whatever, so that they wanted to make sure you hit that island. Well, they flew and 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 they flew. Now, I don't know whether you know much about the ocean. Any of you ever been out on the ocean, away from land? I mean, it's one thing to stand on land and look out across the ocean. It's something else to be out on the ocean when you can't see land. There was a guy from Kansas who was in the Army back many years ago, and he was on a troop ship, and they were going out across the ocean heading toward England or some. No, they were in the Pacific Ocean. Well, anyway, there was he was standing there, you know, looking out across water. Everywhere you look, nothing but water, water, water everywhere. And he was just amazed at so much water. I mean, Kansas, they don't have that much water. I have a son who lives in Kansas. They have water, but not like that. Well, a guy from Florida who had been raised on the ocean edge, he came walking out beside of him and he heard this kid say, wow, look at all that water. And the guy from Florida walked up beside and said, young man, you don't know what you're looking at. You're just looking at the surface. It's 5 miles deep right here. And a guy from Kansas nearly drowned standing up over the water. I mean, he never thought about it going down that far. As a matter of fact, there's places in the Pacific Ocean that's 7 miles deep. That's deeper than the tallest mountain is in the Himalayas. That's a lot of water. Well, anyway, here these guys were flying out across all of this water. And they were up at 10,000 feet. They were above the clouds, and they were flying along. If you've ever been in one of those kind of planes, that droning noise of those engines, all the time, you know, hour after hour after hour. And because Rickenbacker was kind of an important guy, and he had a military, come on, you can do better than that, had a military what? Attaché. Yeah, you gotta somehow. Attaché. Well, they had put two cots in the plane for these very important people. Well, there were the five guys that were the crew, and then there were the two guys, the important guy, Rickenbacker and the attaché. But then they had picked up another guy in Hawaii who had been was being sent back to his group. He was on a bomber crew too, but he had become very ill, and he had what in those days was called yellow jaundice. I had yellow jaundice in the seventh grade. I was sicker than a monkey, I'll tell you that. Nowadays, they don't call it yellow jaundice. Anybody know what they call it now? Something worse. Well, anyway, he had been for 48 days in the hospital, and he had been very, very sick. He was somewhat better and was getting better, and he was on the plane, too, taken back. So they had 8 people. You know, and after a while, the navigator said to the pilot, Captain, we should be within sight of the island now. Oh, good. So they dropped down below the clouds. they couldn't see anything but water anywhere. And they could see miles this way and that way and this way. It must be a little island, somebody said. Well, no, you ought to be able to see it. You can land an airplane on it. Well, anybody see any land? No. Well, get those guys on the radio and see. So they got them on the radio and said, we should be over you somewhere now. Can you hear us? No. Could you give a fix, a radio fix that we could follow in and find the island? Well, we don't have that technology installed yet. It's still in a box. Well, that's helpful. Well, another guy came on and said, hey, we heard your call. We're at such and such an island. You can come and land at our island. They looked on their map and found that's 1,000 miles away. And the pilot looked at his gas gauge and said, we got maybe enough for 700 miles, maybe not that much. Can't get to your island. We got to get this island. So they said, why don't you guys, do you have anti-aircraft guns? Oh, yeah. Well, every few minutes, fire some up there and they explode in the sky, you know. Big orange ball and then a black bunch of smoke. Said, set them for 7,000 feet. We'll be flying along at 10,000 feet and we should be able to see the explosion. Okay. We shot some. Did you see them? No. The clouds had kind of disappeared. Shoot them again. Shoot them every 15 minutes. They never did see them. Pilot says, we have 3 hours worth of gas. We got to get down. Well, they flew, and they said, you know, we need to do what we were taught to do. I'm sorry, there were 4 hours of gas. We need to do what we're taught to do. If you get lost at sea, you fly what they call a box pattern. You go an hour this way, an hour this way, an hour this way, and an hour this way. Because by so doing, you can see all that's inside the box. Besides, you can see what's way outside the box, and you cover a whole bunch of ocean visually. Everybody was watching, yeah, seeing if they could see anything. Well, they flew, and they flew, and they flew, and they were getting to a critical place. And finally, the pilot says, we have less than an hour to go, and this plane's going to go down. So since Captain Rickenbacker was a senior person on board, and the pilot was the captain, but he was a little busy, so he said to Captain Rickenbacker, he said, prepare this plane for a crash landing in the water. Now remember, nobody had ever landed a big four-engine plane in the water without killing people. They looked at each other. How would you like to have that? You know, there's six in that row and two up here. And these eight people, they kind of looked at each other and thought, which of us is going to die? I mean, this was a very serious moment for them. And so Captain Rickenbacker said, well, first, if we make it down to the water, we got to have this thing float as long as possible, so we can get out. So throw out everything that's not tied down. Well, they had 5 sacks of very high priority mail. First thing to go, 5 sacks of high priority mail was now not air mail, now it was waterlogged mail. And then out went the cots that these high priority people was to sleep on. They threw those out, but they kept the mattresses, because they might need those for cushion. They threw out everything they could throw out. Suitcases, I mean, briefcases with very important papers in them. Finally, the pilot said, I've got to start down. So
So everybody, get in your place. Captain Rickenbacker had told him, okay, everybody, this is your place and that's your place, and belt yourself in and get the mattresses. And he sat in a place, and he had a parachute beside his head here. That's the front of the plane. So he was sitting kind of sideways. A guy on the other side was sitting kind of sideways, and he had a cushion also somehow. And then they had the two mattresses, and the guys had backed up to the mattresses behind the pilot and the co-pilot seats, and they had tied themselves in because this is a serious thing. Captain Rickenbacker happened to see something, and there was a 60-foot piece of rope. Might need that. So he wrapped it around his body, 60 feet. Finally, he could look over the pilot's shoulder, and he said, we're 100 feet off the water, everybody. Brace yourself. 75 feet, 50 feet, 30 feet, 20 feet, 10 feet. And the guy back in the radio room was still going, SOS, 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 and nobody was hearing him. Nobody was responding. SOS, SOS. And he said, cut the SOS, because, you know, the guy's going to be hurt bad. So he jumped and braced himself at the last second. And the pilot finally said, here we go. And then he pulled the nose of that plane up. I should tell you this. There's 12-foot seas. It wasn't flat. And so the pilot turned like a valley between the waves, the big 12-foot waves. He turned that big plane with the big wide wings, and the engines had all been shut off. Everything was quiet. They were just right over top of the water. And finally he turned the nose up in the air and hooked the tail. Hooked the tail in the, I got my tail hooked here. Okay. He hooked the tail in the water, which helped slow it down just a little bit. And finally, the front came down. Splash, the big wing dug into the waves. And the plane went from going like 100 miles an hour to dead stopped in 10 steps, 30 feet. That's stopping quick. That's like hitting a brick wall, right? Well, anyway, the guy in the radio room, he wasn't really belted down, and he ricocheted around a little bit and cut his nose really bad. And the guy sitting across from Eddie Rickenbacker, he didn't get himself braced just right, and he wrenched his neck and his back, oh, really bad, and he was in terrible pain. Everybody else seemed to do okay. And they had got their emergency supply box and set it right underneath the hatch where they go out. And they got their extra water and they put it there. And they had some thermoses, so they filled those with coffee. And a guy put a whole bunch of cream in one. He said, I like a lot of cream in my coffee. Why waste the cream, he thought. So he poured it in there, and they had these thermoses all packaged there, ready to take out with them. Well, when it hit the water, they were kind of, you know, like you would be if you hit a brick wall. And this thing, they had unlatched it so they make sure it would open. Well, when it hit the water, the whole lid flew off. And there was a guy who was assigned, pull these two handles immediately when you hit water. Well, he pulled the handles, and that threw two life rafts out onto the wings, and they inflated immediately. You know, here they were out there. Then there was another one, a two-man. These were three men. There was another two-man that you had to pump yourself, and they got it out. And they got out on the wing, and the plane was still floating. It was sinking very slowly, but it was floating, and everybody was happy and that they were survived. Nobody was killed, and they got in their rafts, And then somebody said, "Who's got the emergency supplies?" I forgot. They're still in the plane. Well, we got to go back and get them. We got to have water. We got to have food. We may be out here for days. The plane kept going. They said, "No, no, we can't go back in, because if you go in there, you'll get trapped. That stuff will be down underwater. You'll be in there searching around, and who knows where they floated to, and you'll go down with the plane." So it was decided not to go back. After a bit, they rose up on one of those big swells, and they saw the plane tail stick up in the air for just a few seconds, you know, and it headed miles down. Somebody said, "Look! Floating in the water were four oranges." So they were able to get those four oranges, and that's all they had. Now there's eight people. The only food they have now is four little oranges. They have no water. Somebody said, "I remember, I've got six chocolate bars." And somebody else said, "Oh, I got two." "Well, hang on to those." Well, they did. A couple of days later, they said, "We better break out a chocolate bar." And when they did, they were green and squishy from the seawater. They threw them away. Well, they had a pistol-like thing that shot flares, and they had 18 flares that were in the raft. They found nine of them didn't work. Nine of them were duds. They go, I don't know whether you want to look in the end of that or not. It's kind of like lighting a firecracker, and it goes, tss. And you think, "Well, that thing's no good," and you throw it down, and it goes, bang! You know, you don't know whether it's going to go off or not. So you don't want to look down the end of that thing, just in case, you know? So, but they kept a little, you know, these things are like shotgun shells, about that long and about this big around. So they kept these things, even if they were bad, because they're a container now, okay? And maybe you need to have a container to catch water in or something. So anyway, they tried to save everything they could. Well, they took the rope from around him and tied the three things together. Now, let me explain something to you. The two-man raft was like an inner tube with a bottom in it, and two guys were in it, but it was so tight. The only way they could sit was facing each other. That guy's legs are across this guy's shoulders, and your legs are across his shoulders. And the three-man raft was big enough for 1.5 people, but there were three guys had to get in it. Well, they went on. They eventually ate their oranges. Somebody said, "You know, in my life vest, I found two fishing lines with a hook." And they tried, have you ever tried to catch a fish with a hook with no bait? They considered, "You know, we could cut off his earlobe right there." Serious! Somebody else said, "How about the end of my finger?" Somebody else said, "No, I need my finger. How about my little toe?" And they said, "This is not a good idea to cut ourselves up. And, well, we can't catch fish without bait." And they were so thirsty, so thirsty. Finally, Captain Rickenbacker was sitting there, and he had an old gray hat that his wife had tried to throw away for years. But he had it with him, and he had it on, protecting him from the sun a little bit. He was sitting there dozing, and he felt something. He looked out, and all the rest of the guys were staring at him like this. He says, "Something's on my hat." "Must be a seagull." Now, they were thousands of miles from land. Seagulls tend not to go that far away from land. But he he began this. Took him a long time, much longer than it's taken me. You know, he thought, if I grab real quick, I don't know exactly where it is, and I may just knock it off. So he got up there, and that bird just, he got to the place that he got his hand clear around its leg before he did this. And it took about 1 second to wring its neck. Yanked the feathers off. Now he had a naked bird right there in front of everybody. Well, anyway, they had a knife that was in there. It was a sheath knife, you know, like a hunting knife, that was in their survival raft. And so there were seven pairs of eyes watching him as he cut it exactly, tried to make it. Everybody had the same amount. Have you ever tried to eat a raw seagull? He said, it's terrible, but it's food, okay? But they saved the insides for fish bait, and they passed around these things, bones and all. They crunched them up and swallowed it. Oh, and that probably saved their life, because then they could fish, and they caught a few little fish. And they cut them up same way, and they had a two-course meal, birds and fish. But they didn't have any water. But you see, they had been having prayer meetings. They'd pull their rafts together, and they would have a prayer meeting. Twice a day, they'd have a prayer meeting. And one of the guys had a little Bible that had a zipper waterproof cover. And so every day he read from the Bible. Well, this day, after they had had their birds and their fish and they were about to die from thirst, he opened the Bible and he read Matthew 6:31-34. Would you read that for me? Matthew 6:31-34. You probably know this verse, these verses. I mean, your preacher voice now.
Therefore, do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For after all these things the Gentiles seek, for your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you.
And Captain Cherry, who had been the pilot, said, read that again. And so he read it again. And the thing that amazed him was, in their prayer that morning, they had prayed for food. And they got food that very day. They were able to catch fish. They had a bird. Wow! He answered our prayer. And in the prayer, I'll make a synopsis sometimes of what I read. In the prayer, this time, the captain prayed. Now, I have his prayer written out here. I want to read it to you. He said, at the next prayer meeting, the commander prayed, and he prayed, and he called God Old Master. Old Master. And here's what he said. Old Master, we called on you for food and you delivered. We ask you now for water. We've done the best we could. If you don't make up your mind to help us pretty soon, I guess that's all there'll be to it. It looks like the next move is up to you, Old Master. James Whitaker didn't believe in God. And here's what he thought. I mean, he participated in the Lord's Prayer and things, but just as a ritual. But here's what he thought. He says, in his own mind, just praying in his mind, he said, "Here's your choice, old master, to make a believer out of Jim Whittaker. If there is indeed a God, how could he ignore a sincere prayer like that? If you do, you must be a pretty heartless being." It wasn't long until they noticed something. They noticed a white, fluffy cloud out there. And as they watched that white, fluffy cloud, it got darker and darker and darker and darker until it was a black cloud. And then they noticed this blue sheet hanging down below it. What do you suppose that was? Rain. And what is rain? Water. And they watched it. And it came closer and closer and closer until they could see big splashes here and there in the water around them. And they began crying, "Rain, rain, rain, over here, rain," as if the rain had an ear, you know, "rain, over this way." And then they had these little paddles in there that they couldn't do much laying on their back, but they tried to paddle toward the rain, hoping that the rain would paddle toward them. And after a bit, splat, they began getting hit with these drops of water. And you could look out there and see, they looked like a bunch of birds in the nest, you know, trying to catch water in their mouth. And occasionally, they would get some. Oh, it was so good. And then the rain came in sheets. And for over an hour, it poured the rain down on them. And they took clothes off of them, and everything was crusted with salt. But they were able to wash the salt out of clothes. And then they would soak the water, let it get, and then they would squeeze it into whatever container they had, and they'd soak it again and squeeze some more until they caught quite a little bit of water. Old master came through again. And as time went on, we're out of time, but as time went on, they saw a plane. And they yelled and waved their arms and stuff, but the plane didn't see them. They saw another time, they saw two planes, but they didn't see them. But somebody said, "Look, if there's planes, we haven't seen planes. We must be near something." And somebody said, "Yeah, maybe Japanese. They might come out and sink our ship, if you call that thing a ship." And finally, they saw two planes coming right out of the sun, right at them. And they saw them. Now, there's one thing I need to mention. They had separated. One of the guys had died. He drank seawater at night when no one was watching, and it killed him. It will kill you. So they had rolled him into the ocean. But then there was one guy in that donut raft, and he took off by himself. And one of the big rafts said, "We're going to go our way." So they went off. They wanted to die. They didn't want to see other people die, you know. So they just... Well, the plane came, saw them. One of the planes circled around Captain Rickenbacker and the other two that were with him, and the other plane left. Well, it went around and around, and after a bit, it had pontoons, and it landed. It came up to where they were, and they had the guy with the bad back, and they loaded him in the plane. And he said, "We only have room for one inside, so we're going to tie you two guys to the wing." So they got him up on the wing, straddled this strut, and tied him on. He said, "Now we're 40 miles from the island, but there's a PT boat on the way out. We're going to meet it." So they took them. And when they got to the PT boat, the guys on the boat, "Yay for you! We thought you were dead. By the way, we found the other two rafts. They're okay too." Well, they were all saved. All but one survived. Years and years went by. There was a crazy old man, they thought, down in Florida. They would see him every Friday afternoon, toward the late afternoon, come walking down the beach with a bucket in his hand and a funny-looking old hat on his head. He David come down and he'd go out on a pier. He'd go clear out to the end of the pier. And when he'd get out to the end of the pier with his bucket in his hand, all of a sudden, there were all these birds would come down from the sky and they'd circle around and they'd walk around him and he has shrimp in his bucket. He would take the shrimp and he'd hold it up and a seagull would come down and grab that shrimp. And every time a seagull grabbed the shrimp, he would say, "Thank you. Thank you. Thank you." Every Friday, "Thank you," until all of his shrimp was gone. And then he'd take his bucket and he'd walk back down the pier. And these birds would fly around him or walk around him. And some of them would walk him all the way to the steps going up off the beach. Others would land on his hat and land on his shoulders, and he'd never knock them off. He would just let them ride. Crazy old guy. Did I mention his name was Ed? Why was he saying thank you? Because it was a seagull that saved their life. Really, it was Old Master that saved their life. I love books. I have so many wonderful stories in my books. Stories about how God has done marvelous things for people that do not deserve it. Now, I don't know how old you happen to be right now, but you are a storybook in the making. I don't know what your life will be like. It really depends on whether you have turned your life over to God and He will direct you. Oh, I've had lots of exciting things happen in my life. You know, I've survived many things. I've been knocked silly with lightning, and I've been in an explosion that blew me out of my shoes. And I've lots of things. And I'm still here, and I keep thanking Old Master because he's watched over me. And may the Lord continue to watch over you.